This lecture is produced by Stone Kingdom Ministries of Asheville, North Carolina. Follow along in your Bible as James Brueggemann shares good news from God's Word. For a sample copy of our publication and a catalog of the resources available, write to Stone Kingdom Ministries, Post Office Box 5695, Asheville, North Carolina, zip code 28813. You may also visit us on the web at www.stonekingdom.org. Your regular financial support is what makes this ministry possible, and we are grateful to you for that. And now, here is Bible teacher James Brueggemann.
This is the second half of the message, which we've entitled The Ark Reunited. We left off talking about the musical instruments that David and the whole procession were using as they worshiped and celebrated bringing the Ark up to Jerusalem. And we noted that it's not the instrument itself that's good or bad, but the music that's performed on it. However, in view of what happens next in our story, some might question whether or not all these musical instruments were actually pleasing to God, because it says in 2 Samuel 6 and verse 6, "And when they came to Nacon's threshing floor, Uzzah put forth his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen shook it. And the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Uzzah, and God smote him there for his error. And there he died by the ark of God." Well, that removes the question about the propriety of the musical instruments. Uzzah's being killed had nothing whatsoever to do with the musical instruments used in the worship celebration. Now, if we turn over to the parallel passage in 1 Chronicles 13, we read this in verse 9. "And when they came unto the threshing floor of Kidon, Uzzah put forth his hand to hold the ark, for the oxen stumbled." We'll stop there and exclaim, "Oh no, not another discrepancy." First, it was Nacon's threshing floor, according to 2 Samuel 6:6, and now the word tells us here that it was the threshing floor of Kidon. What kind of games is the father playing here? Well, as usual, the apparent contradictions are not really contradictions at all when one studies oneself to be approved. I think our father puts them in there to force us to look deeper. And when we do, we are often rewarded with some new gem of a discovery. We will search for the deeper meaning in a moment. Let's read the next verse here, in 1 Chronicles. Verse 10, "And the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Uzzah, because he smote him, because he put his hand to the ark, and there he died before God." So there we have it again. It wasn't the guitars or the tambourines that were the problem. It was because Uzzah put his hand to the ark. And now turn back to 2 Samuel 6, and we'll pick up in verse 8. "And David was displeased because Yahweh had made a breach upon Uzzah, and he called the name of the place Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of Yahweh that day and said, 'How shall the ark of Yahweh come to me?' So David would not remove the ark of Yahweh unto him into the city of David. But David carried it aside into the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite." Let's stop here now and examine the situation. David was upset because God had made a breach upon Uzzah. What is a breach? Well, the dictionary says that it's a rupture, a break, a gap, an opening. It's the space between the severed parts of a solid body, parted by violence. So whatever happened to poor Uzzah, there was some kind of opening or break or severing that happened to his body. Now it says that David was displeased. And I don't know about you, but when I was first reading this passage, I assumed that David was upset with God. But as I pondered it in the total context, I believe he was upset with himself. It's a parallel to the story of the priests of Nob, where David saw that it was his action that eventuated in Doeg the Edomite's slaughter of the 85 priests of Nob. We covered that some months ago back in 1 Samuel chapter 22. And there, David blamed himself for that tragedy. And it's the same thing here. Uzzah is slain. David basically stops the procession in its tracks. They're practically in the driveway of Obed-Edom's property. So David gets permission to park the cart with the ark there for the time being. he has to stop and ponder why this tragedy occurred. It says David was fearful of Yahweh. Why? Well, he was afraid that if they continued the procession, God might smite somebody else. Until David figures out what went wrong, he plans to leave the ark on the cart right there at Obed-Edom's house. Well, what did go wrong? Keep your marker here, turn to Numbers chapter 4. Sooner or later, David was reminded of the laws of the holy things. Back in the books of the laws, when God was instructing Moses, and he in turn instructed the people on how to build the tabernacle and all its accoutrements, and how to handle or transport these items, these were part of those regulations. Numbers chapter 4, verse 1. And the Lord should be Yahweh. Anytime you see Lord in all capital letters, it's where the translators took out God's name and put in the Lord. Of course, Lord is not his name. His name is Yahweh. So the Hebrew says, and Yahweh spoke unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, down to verse 4 now, this shall be the service of the sons of Kohath in the tabernacle of the congregation about the most holy things. And when the camp setteth forward, Aaron shall come and his sons, and they shall take down the covering veil and cover the Ark of the Testimony with it. Ark of the Testimony is the Ark of the Covenant. Verse 6, and shall put thereon the covering of badger's skins, and shall spread over it a cloth holy of blue, and shall put in the staves thereof. And then it continues with the regulations concerning the other pieces of furniture, and we pick up again in verse 15. And when Aaron and his sons, now who are they? Priests, right. When they have made an end of covering the sanctuary and all the vessels of the sanctuary, as the camp is set forward, or as the camp is to set forward, after that, the sons of Kohath, they were Levites also, but they were not of the sons of Aaron, so they were not priests. They shall come to bear it, but they shall not touch any holy thing, lest they die. These things are the burden of the sons of Kohath in the tabernacle of the congregation. We need to notice several things here. First of all the work for the service of the tabernacle is being done by the tribe of Levi. But within the Levite tribe, there were two main classes, priests and non-priests. It was the job of the priests to actually dismantle the Holy of Holies and cover the Ark. The priests even inserted the carrying poles into the rings of the corner of the Ark. Now, just to draw a quick sketch here, this was the Ark of the Covenant, looking at it from the front, and had a couple of cherubim. These are my idea of cherubim, angels. Their wings reached out and touched one another. And there was golden rings here, and that's where they stuck the staves or the poles through, wooden poles through the golden rings. So I say, when the priests were dismantling it, they even put the poles through there, and they had the thing covered with the badger skin and then with a blanket of blue. And then, and only then, were the sons of Kohath able to come forward and pick up the ark and move forward with the camp of Israel. So, again, to remind us, the sons of Kohath were not priests, but they were Levites. And how did they carry the ark? They never touched the ark itself, did they?
Yeah.
They bore the ark upon their shoulders by means of the carrying poles. Now, in the antitype, the fulfillment of the type, we taught you long ago that since our bodies correspond to the tabernacle, then where is the ark? We bear it on our shoulders. It's right here. This is the ark. That's why I said earlier, the ark is the mind. It's upstairs, downstairs, mezzanine. Upstairs in the mind, the brain, the communication center, downstairs in the reproduction department, and then in the middle, the mezzanine, in the heart department. So now David knows that Uzzah got zapped because A, he was not a Levite, B, because even the Levites were not allowed to touch the ark itself on pain of death. Now, does this mean that the priests of the Levites were not allowed to touch it? Once it was built, I don't think anyone touched it, with the rare exception of the high priest, and only that on the very specific instruction given at the moment by Yahweh speaking from above the ark itself, because God said, I will meet with you there above the ark. And that's where the high priest went into the most holy place and was able to communicate directly with God. And if there was any reason, as there was one time that I can recall, maybe you can recall some other time, but I couldn't. There was one time when there would have been a reason to open it up. What was that? To put in the pot of manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the two stone testaments. And so God probably told him what to do. As I've said before, back in our studies of the tabernacle, I've said this back then, that I believe the Ark of the Covenant fits all the requirements to have been a very high-powered electrical condenser or capacitor. In other words, it held a very high voltage electrical charge. And if someone touched it who was not properly grounded, he would be zapped. I believe that's what happened to Uzzah. When I was in the Air Force, I was an AC&W radar repair technician. AC&W stands for Aircraft Control and Warning Radar. And these were not the relatively small radar sets that you see out at the airports and on ships and so forth. These were the radar sites that ringed the continental United States to protect the borders. These were monster radar sets, and it took a lot of juice to power them. Now, in tech school, which was a year long for me, for radar repair, we were given regulations on how to dismantle parts of the radar and to repair them. Just like Moses and Aaron were given regulations concerning the ark, we were trained to remove all of our jewelry, our watches, rings, anything metal, belt buckles, from our body before we went in to be working where the juice was on. And in some cases, it is dangerous to work on a piece of equipment even when it is not plugged in. For example, now I haven't kept up with electronics 30 years ago, but years ago it used to be that there was a place near the back of the picture tube in a color TV set that if you touched it, you would get zapped with 25,000 volts. Black and whites were 10,000 volts. And it doesn't matter if the TV is plugged in or not, because the charge is still on that thing, and if you touch it, you'll get zapped. Could kill you. Very, very dangerous. The charge is stored there. Now, if you're still in Numbers chapter 4, you'll notice that in verse 6, the priests covered the ark with what is called badger skins. Other translations may say porpoise skin or a sea cow skin or something else. The point is, it was a heavy leather type material. Leather. Now, is leather a good electrical conductor or insulator? It's an insulator. And so the covering of the ark with these skins also served to help prevent accidental electrocution. In our story of Uzzah, there is no indication that the ark was covered up in any way. The poor chap got electrocuted, in my opinion. And I think I read somewhere that some electrical engineer has estimated that the ark would pack a charge of somewhere near 100,000 volts. Yeah, I know it's the current that kills you, but we're not going to get overly technical here. Let me tell you, folks, when you get hit with a discharge of electricity that big, wherever Uzzah made contact with the ark, the discharge of presumably direct current would, number one, open a hole, in other words, a breach, in his body. And secondly, it would literally throw him off his feet and toss him some distance, quite dead. Moreover, the discharge might even look like a mini bolt of lightning. And now we can go back to this supposed discrepancy between the names of the threshing floor. Some lexicons will give the definition prepared for Nakon. But other helps books tell us that the phrase Goren Nakon means the threshing floor of the stroke. Did Uzzah get struck? He probably never knew what hit him. And the other word, Kidon, means a javelin. Does a mini lightning bolt possibly resemble
an instantaneous javelin. You know, in the Star Wars movies, what they call those weapons? You know, they made them into toys. Kids played with lightsabers. Right?
Yeah, they could cut somebody in half with a
light. Yeah, lightsaber. So, kidon. You know, in other words, light referred to as a lance, a saber, a spear, a javelin. Another meaning offered for the phrase goron or goren kidon is threshing floor of destruction. So while it is possible that there was a man who had two names, Nakon and Kidon, who owned the threshing floor, I tend to think that these were descriptions of the place given by the people after the event. And as we saw, David himself gave it a name, Perez Uzzah, which means the breach of Uzzah. All right, so we know that the tech manual for the ark prescribed that the sons of Kohath not touch it, or else they'll be killed. But there was something else that was done wrong in the transport of the ark. What was it? They had it on a cart instead of carrying it with the poles on their shoulders. Wherever did they come up with a harebrained idea of putting it on a cart? From the heathen. That's where they got the idea. Turn back to 1 Samuel 4 now. We mentioned this in the first message. We're going to study it a little further now. We began our study of contrasting the character of Saul with the character of David many months ago. And we began in 1 Samuel chapter 9, and so we did not cover these earlier chapters because chapter 9 was where King Saul was crowned king, and that's where the story began. So we don't have time to cover these chapters in any depth today, but there are parts of four chapters here that I want to tie into our story today. So just to summarize, at this time in Israel, chapter 4, Eli was the high priest. Now, Eli was a descendant of Aaron through Ithamar, his son, and Eli combined the offices of high priest and judge. That's the first time that the two offices were combined. He presided over the services of the tabernacle, which was then located in Shiloh, and Shiloh is right there. In chapter 4, we find the Israelites went to war with the Philistines. In a battle which was located between Ebenezer and Aphek. Let's see. I think it's right in here, in Ephraim. So in the battle in chapter 4, Aphek, which is not written on this map, is about right there, and Ebenezer right there, and so they met in the middle on the battlefield. And this is where Israel lost 4,000 men in the first battle. And so they decided they ought to have the Ark of the Covenant go out with them to battle. And Eli, the high priest, let his two sons, who were named Hophni and Phinehas, go with the Ark into the next battle. Now, the Israelites had this prayer that they prayed whenever they carried the Ark into battle. They had used it ever since the wilderness when Moses first prayed it. And you don't need to turn there, but it's in Numbers 10, verse 35. And it goes like this. And it came to pass when the ark set forward that Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord," or "Rise up, Yahweh, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let them that hate thee flee before thee." Well, we saw in 1 Samuel 4, or we didn't see yet, but I'm telling you now. 1 Samuel 4, verse 10, we learn that the Philistines then, after they took the ark into battle, the Philistines slew 30,000 Israelites instead of just 4,000, and the rest of them were scattered to their own tents. You see, the wording in this prayer is very precise. It was a prayer that God would scatter his enemies. It didn't say, "Let our enemies be scattered." And since Israel and Eli and his sons had greatly fallen away from God's laws, well, God's enemies at that time were his own Israel people. Let's put Israel's loss in context of today, shall we? How many people were killed on 9/11? 3,000. 3,000. Israel lost 10 times that in this one battle, 30,000. Not only did they lose all those men, but verse 11 tells us that Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were killed, and the Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the first question that might come to mind is, why didn't the Philistines get zapped when they touched the Ark? Well, since we're talking about the Almighty Creator of the universe here, now I can't be sure of this, so I'm just guessing. But I'm just guessing that Yahweh knew where the off switch was and how to discharge the voltage. You see, he had another plan for the Philistines, which is to say that God might have different ways of dealing with different peoples, different nations. We'll come back to that in a moment, but to continue chronologically with the story, when the messenger came back to Shiloh and told old Eli, because he was 98 years old, that his sons were dead and the ark was captured, it says in verse 18 that he fell over backwards and broke his neck and died. Now, many of you here that have heard Ron Ogis speak have heard him tell this before, but many on our tape ministry have not. So remember, repetition is the key to learning. Because Eli, like Saul, was a type of the church. He was 98 years old, and he was blind, and he was very fat and heavy. When we first began studying King Saul, we pointed out that Saul was a type of the Pentecost church. Now, this is not to say the Pentecostal denomination, but by the Pentecost church, we mean the church from the day of Pentecost, A.D. 33, until roughly today. So Saul, the king, was a type of the church under the Pentecost age. And all of this, by the way, is covered in great detail in Stephen Jones's book, The Secrets of Time, about the timing of the Pentecost age and so forth, and the Tabernacles age that we're now coming into. But Saul is a type of the Pentecost church because we always found Saul associated with wheat, as opposed to another grain, and asses, jackasses. Those are symbols of Pentecost, wheat and asses. And we have a book written by Stephen Jones called The Wheat and Asses of Pentecost, which gives all the Bible proofs that the wheat and asses are symbolic of Pentecost. And so what is enlightening here in verse 18 is that Eli fell backwards and broke his neck and died, because this was in keeping with the law in Exodus 13:13, which states that unless it is redeemed by a sacrificial lamb, an ass must have its neck broken. Eli, symbolizing the church, was an ass. And so because there was no lamb present to redeem him, he fell backwards and his neck was broken. Did you know that there are only two places in the Bible where the word fell and the word backward are in the same sentence? This is one, right here with Eli. The other, you don't need to turn there, it's in John, you'll remember this, John chapter 18, verses 5 and 6, where Jesus is out there in the Garden of Gethsemane, and the bad guys, Judas and a band of officers and soldiers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, these men are coming for him, and Jesus says, he gets up and goes to him and says, "Who are you looking for?" And in John 18, 5, it says, "They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus said unto them, I am he." Actually, the word "he" is in italics, which means it wasn't in the original. He said, "I am." Now, what's God say his name was back to Moses? "I am." Can you imagine Jesus and the power of his voice? He said, "I am." You know what happened when he said, "I am"? As soon then as he had said unto them, "I am," they went backward and fell to the ground. All of those people fell backwards to the ground, just like Eli. But you know what? None of them broke their necks. None of them died. Why? Because Jesus, the Ark, the Lamb, was present. And so they were redeemed from having their necks broken. Isn't that amazing? All right, so the Philistines took the Ark back to one of their cities named Ashdod, which is right here, Ashdod. And they placed it in the temple right next to their god named Dagon, D-A-G-O-N, Dagon. But remember, Yahweh will deal with the heathen differently sometimes. And so the Philistines got their first inkling that trouble was brewing when the next morning they go into their temple and they find that their doggone Dagon god had fallen on his face in front of Yahweh, the Ark. That's in 1 Samuel 5, verses 1 to 5. And we're not reading this, I'm just summarizing it. So what'd they do, the Philistines? They took their God and they set him back up. This is symptomatic of false gods. False gods always need propping up. How are they propped up? By the works of man, of course. As my friend Ron would say, don't laugh. It just encourages me. Ron sends his love to all of you, by the way. I just spoke with him the other day. Oh, you go right ahead. I'm glad I didn't say what I was going to say about Eli, which Ron says, you know, of course. Should I really get her, send her under the table? Okay.
It's not quite ready, but
she can handle it. Okay. Eli symbolized the church, and the wheat and the asses symbolized the church under Pentecost, and Eli was fat and heavy. He was a fat ass. Remember, this is church. Yeah. God has a sense of humor. He's the one that wrote this. Blame him.
I know several.
Praise God. All right. So, Dagon had fallen on his face, and he needed propping up. And then Yahweh began causing terrible plagues and destruction to come upon the people of Ashdod. So they sent the ark on to one of the other five powerful cities of the Philistines, namely to the city of Gath, which is where later on Goliath would come from. And so a lot of men in the city of Gath got tumors, it says in the Bible, in their private parts. And they died very quickly. Hemorrhoids. It's tumors, I think. Is that prostate cancer? Very quick acting. Boom, they were dead, just like that. I don't mean one day, but very quick. Others survived the tumors. And so they sent the ark. They said, we don't want this thing. Send it down to the other city. And so they wanted to send it to Ekron, or as I like to say, Akron, because I'm from Ohio. There's Akron. I think Akron was named after Ekron. And so the people of Akron said, hey, what are you trying to do? Kill us all? Take that thing away from here. Well, by chapter 6, the Philistine priests and the wise men, got together to figure out what to do with the ark. And the plan they settled on was to build a new cart and hitch up two cows to it that had just given birth. And then set the ark upon it, put it out on the road, and see what happens, see where the cows go. Because if the cows do something so unnatural as to go away from their calves that they had just given birth to, and they head towards Israel, then the Philistines would know that this was God's doing and that God had created and smote them with this great judgment. Now, I love this in verse 9, chapter 6, where it says that in the event the cows don't head towards Israel territory, then the Philistine says, if that's what happens, we'll just have to chalk this up to chance. In other words, coincidence. Now, again, if you're new to the tape ministry, you might not understand why I would love that so much, but it's because if there's one thing that underlies all that we teach, it's the sovereignty of God, meaning that God is in charge of absolutely everything, everybody, for all time. There is no such thing as chance or coincidence. If it happened, it's because God caused it to happen. He planned the whole thing, the good, the bad, the ugly, and all for a good purpose in the end, although we can't see that sometimes when we're going through the bad and the ugly. It hurts, but it's all for good. And so, continuing with the story, as chance would have it, as God would have it, the two milk cows headed straight for the town of Beth Shemesh in Israel. That's verse 13, chapter 6. Incidentally, Beth Shemesh, or Beth Shemesh, which is about right here, Beth Shemesh means the house of the rising sun, which is where the animals bring the ark. You'd have to remember the 1960s to get that one, because there was a group called The Animals that were simultaneous with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and they sang the song, The House of the Rising Sun. There is a house in New Orleans they call the Rising Sun. Has anybody heard that besides me? You've heard it. Okay. Well, the men of Beth Shemesh are ecstatic to see the ark coming back, and so they drop what they're doing as the cart and the ark come to rest. Now, significantly, what they were doing was reaping the wheat harvest. Why does it say wheat, not barley? Because it's telling us something. This has to do with the church in Pentecost, the wheat harvest. So it's again connected and associated with the church age. And of all places, it tells us that the ark comes to rest in the field of Joshua near a great stone. Matthew 13, the parables of Jesus, tell us that the field represents the world. So this comes to rest in the field or the world of Joshua or Yahshua, which is another name for Jesus, the Hebrew name. So we have a triple witness to Jesus right here, because the ark is Jesus, Joshua is Jesus, and the stone represents the Savior as well. Some Levites are there to properly handle the ark, but down in verse 19, tragedy strikes the men of the house of the rising sun. Their curiosity got the best of them, and they evidently lifted the lid and peeked inside. A lot of them did. Maybe they took it off. And it says that 50,000 and 70 men were killed. What? 50,000 and 70 men were killed. Many question that huge number and offer various reasons why it may only have been 70, as Josephus records, or some other possibility. I have my own opinion, but I'm not going to spend time on it, because regardless of the number, it again shows that the ark must be considered most holy. You don't touch it, let alone lift the lid covering and look inside. It is most holy because that is where it belongs, in the most holy place of the tabernacle. Since its capture by the Philistines, which was only, about 7 months, I think, or maybe 3 months, the ark will now be separated from the tabernacle for perhaps as long as 70 years. Now that confused me at first. The men of Beth Shemesh didn't want the ark in their town after all those deaths, and so they sent word to the men of Kiriath Jearim to come and get it, and to take it to their town up high on the hill, which they did. And so in 1 Samuel 7, verse 2, it says that it was there 20 years. I thought, wait a minute, that's confusing. It had to be there longer than that, and so it must mean that it was there 20 years before the next incident, which is recorded there, and that makes sense. And then we know that it was there 20 years, and then 40 years during all the reign of Saul, where David says they inquired not at the Ark of the Covenant. That's 60. And then it was, who knows, early into the reign of David. David reigned for 40 years. Could have been as many as 10 years before this happened. Could have been as few as 1, I suppose. So anywhere from 1 to 10 years. So anywhere from 61 to 70 years, the ark had been separated from the tabernacle. Now, with all this background, we see that the Israelites had, for the most part, forgotten about the ark, forgotten about how to handle it, how to treat it with utmost reverence and respect. And so when David assigned men to bring it to Jerusalem, I don't know if David micromanaged the whole deal and personally specified that they build a cart for it, or if one of his underlings was assigned the task. And if that was the case, perhaps the guys there said, well, the king told me to, you know, get the ark up to Jerusalem. Wonder how we should do that. He's scratching his head and he's talking to the men of Kiriath Jearim, and one of the old guys in town that had been there, he's 80 years old, and he remembered when he was 10 years old that the ark came to town. And he says, I remember, it came here on a cart. And so the guy says, yeah, that's what we'll do. We'll build a cart, and we'll put 2 milk cows in front of it to pull the cart. In any event, all the deaths of the Philistines and the men of Beth Shemesh and the tragic death of Uzal all reminded me of the incident of the strange fire offered by the sons of Aaron, which is, you don't need to turn there, it's in Leviticus 10. Well, you could turn there if you wish. There's something important here. Leviticus 10. I don't know if you remember this, but right after they were finished completing the tabernacle and they were doing like the first time offerings and all that stuff, or shortly thereafter, Aaron had 4 sons, and 2 of them it talks about here, verse 1, Leviticus 10, and Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took either of them his censer, that's a container with a charcoal to put incense in, and put fire therein, and put incense thereon, and offered strange fire before Yahweh, which he commanded them not. And there went out fire, how about a javelin? Electrical discharge, perhaps, again? And there went out fire from Yahweh and devoured them, and they died before Yahweh. And now here's the important thing to remember in all of these events. Verse 3. Then Moses said unto Aaron, this is it that Yahweh spake, saying, I will be sanctified in them that come nigh me, and before all the people I will be glorified. And Aaron held his peace. To be sanctified means to be set apart. In other words, there are certain rules and regulations, certain statutes for approaching near to the presence of the universal Creator. And when one does not comply with those rules, whether it's by ignorance or by presumption, as in the case of Nadab and Abihu, it made no difference. The penalty was quick, it was severe, it was death. Now back to 1 Chronicles 15. So over time, David figured out what the problem had been, because we read here in 1 Chronicles 15, verse 1, and David made him houses in the city of David, and prepared a place for the ark, and pitched for it a tent, in other words, a tabernacle. And so we see that the ark and the tabernacle will be coming back together in the reign of David. Verse 2. Then David said, none ought to carry the ark of God but the Levites. For them has Yahweh chosen to carry the ark of God and to minister unto him forever. And David gathered all Israel together to Jerusalem to bring up the ark of Yahweh unto his place which he had prepared for it. And David assembled the children of Aaron and the Levites. Now verse 11. And David called for Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, and for the Levites, for Uriel, Isaiah, and Joel, Shemaiah, and Eliel, and Aminadab. And he said unto them, ye are the chief of the fathers of the Levites. Sanctify yourselves, both ye and your brethren, that ye may bring up the ark of Yahweh, God of Israel, unto the place that I have prepared for it. Listen to this, verse 13. For because ye did it not at the first, in other words, when they had it on the cart and so forth, Yahweh our God made a breach upon us, for that we sought him not after the due order. In other words, we didn't do things the way we were supposed to. Proper procedure. Didn't follow the tech manual. So the priests and the Levites sanctified themselves to bring up the ark of Yahweh God of Israel, and the children of the Levites bear the ark of God upon their shoulders with the staves thereon, as Moses commanded according to the word of Yahweh. Keep a marker right here. Meanwhile, back in 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 11, messengers were coming to David telling him that God was just blessing the socks off of this guy Obed-Edom, where they'd parked the ark in his front yard or somewhere. And the ark of Yahweh continued in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite 3 months, and Yahweh blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. Obed-Edom means the servant of Edom. This doesn't mean that Obed-Edom was an Edomite. Perhaps his ancestor had been in servitude to an Edomite, but genealogically, genetically that is, Obed-Edom was almost certainly a Levite, being from Gath-Rimmon, which was a Levitical city. Now, if you recall when Joshua came in with the children of Israel and they established 48 cities, which were cities for the Levites only. And Gath-Rimmon was one of those. That's in Joshua 21:24, if you want to look it up. Incidentally, the word Gath-Rimmon means winepress of the pomegranate. But there's more evidence that Obed-Edom was a Levite, because turn back to 1 Chronicles 15 again and verse 16. We see that concomitant with setting up the ark in Jerusalem, David saw to it that proper worship was reestablished. Verse 16. And David spake to the chief of the Levites to appoint their brethren, in other words, Levites, to be the singers with instruments of music, psalteries, and guitars, may I say, and cymbals sounding by lifting up the voice with joy. 17. So the Levites appointed Heman, the son of Joel, and of his brethren Asaph, the son of Berechiah, and of the sons of Merari, their brethren, Ethan, the son of Cushaiah, and with them their brethren of the second degree, Zechariah, Ben, and Jaaziel, and Shemiramoth, and Jehiel, and Uni, and Eliab, and Benaiah, and Maaseiah, and Mattathiah, and Eliphelet, and Mikneiah, and Obed-Edom. Oh, shucks, Ange. And How do you say this last word? And Jael the porter, porters. Okay, back to 2 Samuel 6 and verse 12. And it was told King David, saying, Yahweh hath blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that pertaineth unto him because of the ark of God. So David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom into the city of David with gladness. And it was so that when they that bear the ark of Yahweh had gone 6 paces, he sacrificed oxen and fatlings. This verse might lead some to visualize, in fact, this is the way I pictured it when I first read it, that they got the procession now from Obed-Edom's house going back to Jerusalem, and every 6 paces they stopped and sacrificed oxen and fatlings. But it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't really say that. I think it's more likely that when they first started out, everybody was holding their breath, hoping that the changes they had made in the manner of transportation would be pleasing to God, and he wouldn't zap anybody this time. So that when they began the journey, and they went 6 steps, and they got to 6 steps, okay, let's take a break, have some sacrifice here. They felt secure in the knowledge it was going to be a safe trip. Verse 14, and David danced before Yahweh with all his might, and David was girded with a linen ephod. The ephod was generally, but not exclusively, a garment of the priests. Samuel the prophet was of the tribe of Ephraim, but he was girded in an ephod as a child at the feet of Eli. Now here David was dressed like a priest, and yet no one seems to have been offended by this, nor is there any indication that God was displeased either, as though David were usurping the role of the priest. Because, again contrasting Saul and David, we recall that way back at the beginning of Saul's reign, when Samuel told Saul to wait 7 days and then I'll show up and we'll do a sacrifice. It was Samuel's job. But Saul, on the 7th day, looking at his watch, oh, where's Samuel? And he's getting worried because the Philistines are getting ready to attack and they know they got to have the sacrifice so they get blessed before they go out to war. And Saul's really getting impatient and worried. And finally, he takes it upon himself to do the sacrifice without Samuel. And so he was usurping a role that he did not have. But is that what David did? Not really. You see, when Samuel arrived, he chastised Saul quite severely. Saul acted the part of the priest out of fear and presumption and pride. Pride that he could do the job. They don't need to wait on the prophet. Whereas with David, what a difference attitude and motive and intent makes. Because that wasn't David's attitude at all. Not fearful, not prideful. But rather, David was filled with joy and praise for God. 2 Samuel 6:15. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of Yahweh with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet. And as the ark of Yahweh came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, looked through a window and saw King David leaping and dancing before Yahweh. This is his wife, you know. And she despised him in her heart. She loved David for his good looks, for his daring do, his military prowess, for his courage, perhaps for his ability to command men. But when David demonstrated his humility by being just one of the folks, by not setting himself above the ordinary people in the festivities and in the dancing which accompanied the ark, when Michal saw that, she had her nose stuck way up in the air. This type of behavior was not befitting a king, she sniffed. She was indeed her father's daughter. She was acting like King Saul would have acted. It was pride and haughtiness. She represents the daughter of the Saul church. Yeah. Even as the overcomers are about to rule, as the age of tabernacles comes upon us, there remain some in the church who despise the humility of the overcomers. Overcomers lower themselves. They see themselves as equal or less than others. Even when the overcomers are in offices of authority and in power over others, they are humble. They don't allow themselves to be set above and set apart from the people like most of the clergy and civil rulers have done for the last 2,000 years of the church age. Of course, McCall is the perfect type for many of those same leaders who will resent the overcomers. They will despise them, and yet they will envy them at the same time, just like King Saul did. Verse 17, "And they brought in the ark of Yahweh and set it in his place in the midst of the tabernacle that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before Yahweh." Now, we're running a little long today, so I'm going to go rather quickly over the remainder of this chapter with little comment because before I close, there's a couple of loose ends I want to try to tie together. 18, "And as soon as David had made an end of offering burnt offerings and peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of Yahweh of hosts. And he dealt among all the people, or passed out, even among the whole multitude of Israel, as well as to the women as to the men, to everyone a cake of bread, a good piece of flesh," because they did all these meat sacrifices, right? It was barbecued beef, "and a flagon of wine." In other words, everybody had a fry, a Coke, and a hamburger. Well, they had a cake of bread, there's your bun, had a piece of meat, and a flagon of wine. So they had a sandwich and a glass of wine. "So all the people departed, everyone to his house. Then David returned to bless his household, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said," now she's being really sarcastic here, "how glorious was the king of Israel today, who uncovered himself today in the eyes of the handmaids of his servants, as one of the vain fellows shamelessly uncovereth himself." Now, this does not mean that David didn't have any clothes on. He didn't uncover himself. What he had done was take off his kingly robe and just wore the linen ephod and was just one of the people. But that wasn't enough to satisfy Michal. "And David said unto Michal, it was before Yahweh which chose me before thy father and before all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of Yahweh, over Israel. Therefore I will play before Yahweh. And I will yet be more vile than thus, and will be base in mine own sight. And of the maidservants which thou hast spoken of them shall I be had in honor." In other words, I'm just abasing myself, humbling myself, and you're criticizing me. Well, I'll do it in front of the maidservants, and they will honor me for it. "Therefore Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child unto the day of her death." That was a curse. Now, just to add some possible applications to a point or two of what we've discussed today, the first application I would make is that the cart is our way, not God's way. We can dress up our activities, our worship, we can dress up our behaviors, all we like, but if it's not according to God's instructions, it's not pleasing to Him. God says we are to worship Him in spirit and in truth. If we are not approaching Him in a spirit of reverence and awe, and in a spirit of humility and recognition that He is the sovereign King eternal, if we're not approaching Him seeking truth, but perhaps only to have Him rubber stamp what we want to be the truth, then we're putting the ark on a cart. It might even be a new cart, all decked out with highfalutin doctrines to decorate the Almighty King with worldly symbols and riches. God has nothing against riches per se, but when they get in the way of worshiping Him in truth, then we've got the ark on a cart. That will be bad news. Because as we go along on the road of life, on the way up to New Jerusalem, we're going to hit some speed bumps, and if our ark is on a cart, we'll automatically reach out to try to keep our false picture of God from falling over. But when it does, we will find out that He is the stone that crushes us in our idolatry. Let us rather prostrate ourselves before the cornerstone of the universe, Jesus Christ. The other main idea that I want to reemphasize and make some applications for is that there was a period of time when the ark was separated from the tabernacle. Prophetically, this would say that there was, or still is, a time in the church age, or now in the transition period, when the ark is separated from the tabernacle, the shell of the church, not the buildings, but the ark is separated from the ecclesiastical organizations. Could that possibly be so? Well, we speak of dead churches, don't we? If the Spirit of God is not in them, they are dead, aren't they? And the Spirit of God is the Spirit of Christ. And the two are one and the same as the Holy Spirit, are they not? The triune God, if you will. If the Holy Spirit is not moving in the hearts and lives of the believers of a given church, then that is a dead church. The ark isn't there. The ark is separated from that tabernacle. If a church organization has grown fat, that is, materially wealthy, and blind, like Eli, that is, blind to new truths, and most denominations are, because they box themselves in with the four walls of their doctrine, and they say, we got the truth, and you bring in this other stuff, that's heresy. You bring in that, that's heresy. There is no more truth. We got it all. Just ask them. So if a church has grown fat and or blind like Eli did, and like Eli, if the church's sons are corrupted, the priests are corrupted, all the pedophilia scandals coming out, is it not correct to say that the ark is not there? Speaking of the Christian church in general for the past 2,000 years, this means there are always exceptions. But generally speaking, on many occasions and in many ways, Christ, the ark, has been separated from the church. What separated them? Well, sin, of course. But specifically, it is the methods and the attitudes of those in positions of authority in the church. A spirit of condemnation and of judgment. Do what we say or you'll go to hell. Fry and cry and roast and toast and squirm and burn for all eternity. A lie. If you don't agree with the way we see it, you're wrong and you deserve to go to hell. Condemnation and judgment. No mercy. Remember that the ark was a place of forgiveness of sins. The cover of the ark was called the mercy seat. But the church, in general, remember, would much rather judge and condemn people than to forgive and show mercy. Moreover, like the men of Beth Shemesh discovered, we cannot open the lid, the mercy seat, and have the blessings which are inside the ark until we are a forgiving and a merciful person or people. The power of God is infinitely too strong for these old carnal wineskins. Our wineskins are instantly exploded upon gazing upon the Eternal One. To be merciful and forgiving, this is what overcomers strive for in all things and with all people. And one more point. In the Old Testament, the externals were the types and shadows of what was to come. I don't care if the box called the Ark of the Covenant is in Ethiopia or in the Israeli state or if it's in the state of Arkansas. If it were discovered, our people would make an idol of it. The Old Testament Ark was there to point us to the real Ark, which is Christ living in you and me. The Ark is in your heart and in your mind and in your spiritual reproductive organs, because you are ultimately going to bring forth, you are going to give birth to that totally new man. Man meaning men and women. That new man which is immortal, the incorruptible person that you are destined to become. The scripture says that when we see him, Jesus, we will be like him. The seed is implanted in your feminine soul by the masculine spirit of Christ, and someday you and I will truly be born again into that glory of incorruptible immortality where God will be all in all, meaning God will be everything in everybody. All praise to the eternal Creator. Amen.